You're listening to the GP Supervision Australia podcast, Communication and Feedback in GP Training, A Cultural Lens, presented by Dr. Catherine Casey and Dr. Marissa Magiros. We would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which this recording was produced and pay our respects to their elders past, present, future, and their families.
A very warm welcome on what I think is a really intriguing topic. I love the notion of a cultural lens, the way we can look at something through the prism of our own or someone else's cultural experience. And this is around communication and feedback in GP training, fairly important elements of what we do. And it is a great pleasure to welcome two colleagues, two friends to present. We've got Marissa Magiros, who is a GP in Canberra, and she's a experienced medical educator with the RACGP, and among her interests, doctors' health, changing medical culture, women's health, clinical reasoning, and reducing diagnostic errors. And yes, I sat next to Marissa at a diagnostic error conference a few years ago. We shared that passion. And her colleague, my colleague, Catherine Casey, and Kat's from Sydney, and she is, as her bio says, passionate about general practice and medical education, and that is my experience as well. She's motivated to improve GP training and the quality thereof, works in youth mental health, and a very good aspiration, all Australians to have access to quality GP. So it's a great pleasure to have you both along.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Simon. Thank you so much for the opportunity to present. As Simon's alluded, this is a topic that both Marissa and I have found really fascinating and have really enjoyed learning about and presenting on. So we're really hoping that this might be something that adds just an extra tool to your supervisor toolkit, something that you can take away from tonight and utilize in your general practice training environment and practice. So what we're hoping to achieve is to assist you in exploring international research on cultural differences in communication and feedback, and identify situations where culture may impact communication and feedback in general practice training, so particularly in your general practice with your registrars. We would like you to take away some practical tips that you can use with the GP's training in your practices. We want this to be a safe space to explore the concepts of culture and its impact on communication and feedback. There's a quote from the book, The Culture Map, by the author Erin Meyer, that says, "Most of us have a deep protective instinct for the culture we consider our own. And though we may criticize it bitterly ourselves, we may become easily incensed if someone from outside the culture dares to do so." So there's certainly no intention to compare and say one culture is better than another. This is really about looking at the research and utilizing that information to enhance communication and enhance feedback. I have experienced many cultural differences with my friends. So some of the stories that come to mind are when Sarah, a young woman from China, was planning games for a baby shower party to celebrate a mutual friend's impending birth. I asked her to let me know if she needed any help with planning these games. What I thought I was offering was perhaps some brainstorming or shaping of ideas, maybe even a bit of preparation time. But a few days before the party, Sarah said to me, "Right, you need to organize three games and make them fun." And I was rather shocked. Another time, we had invited a family who had recently immigrated from India to Australia about 2 months before this event, and we'd invited them over for dinner at 6 p.m. on a Thursday evening. They happily accepted the invitation. They were really pleased to be invited to the home of an Australian family. By 7 p.m. on the night of the dinner, our kids were hungry, we hadn't received any messages from the family, and no one was answering our calls. So we figured an hour after the invitation time, they weren't coming. So we sat down and ate dinner. But at 7:45, as we were almost finished dinner, the doorbell rang and the family had arrived for dinner. And there was panic in our house. We had known our friends from Zimbabwe for about 2 years. They had spent time at our house. They'd eaten with us on multiple occasions, but they'd never invited us to their home. So one day my husband asked the culture question. He said, so how do people in Zim arrange to visit one another? And the answer shocked us. They said, oh, if you have to invite people over to your house, it means they are not true friends. True friends will just phone and say, hi, I'm in your area. Are you home for a visit? I'm sure you can all think of situations where you've experienced cultural differences. I wonder if you've had a conversation with someone from a different cultural background to yours when you felt like you just weren't understanding one another. Or perhaps you've experienced a time when Australian culture seems at odds with your own expectations. So these are some of those scenarios to start thinking about as we look at this topic. So every culture has its own worldview, its own behavioural patterns and beliefs. Australia is one of the most culturally diverse countries in the world. The Australian Bureau of Statistics in 2022 revealed 27% of Australians were born overseas, and 49% of Australians have at least one parent who was born overseas. So you can start to imagine just how much our culture impacts on our communication. And I wonder if you've thought about how culture might impact on your interactions with your registrars. So before we go into some of the international research, I thought it would be helpful for us to consider GP registrars or GPs in training in Australia. And as I thought about this, it made me wonder how much we know of our registrars' journeys. You know, do you know the journey your registrar has taken from where they were born, where they grew up, the country where they studied at medical school, what has brought them to Australia to continue their training? One of my registrars grew up in Rwanda and actually got a scholarship to do her medical school in China. And she was then doing general practice training in Australia. So you can see really diverse experiences of culture. So ACRM data shows that approximately 30% of trainees received their primary medical qualifications overseas, with the top ones being the UK, India, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, and South Africa as the top few. And the RACGP website reveals that in August 2021, 40% of RACGP members had received their primary medical qualifications overseas, with the top 10 countries. Quite a bit of overlap in those top 10 between the two colleges, with India, UK, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, and Bangladesh being common to the top 10 lists of both. So the research that we're talking about is from the Culture Map by Erin Meyer. Erin Meyer, having grown up in a small town in the USA, married a French man, and now works as a professor in cross-cultural management at an international college located in Paris. Erin and her team have undertaken a decade of research into cultural differences across the world, and then conducted another 10 years of focus groups and training discussions with organizations around the world to refine that research. So Erin Meyer has mapped cultures across 8 different scales, and they're adding more cultures to their research as time progresses. Each country they study, each culture, is mapped on a continuum across each scale, from one extreme to the other, on the scales of communicating, evaluating, persuading, leading, deciding, trusting, disagreeing, and scheduling. We're just going to focus on the first two of these scales. So communicating on a scale from low context to high context, and evaluating on a scale from direct negative feedback to indirect negative feedback. And we'll explain what those descriptors mean shortly. If you'd like more information or would like to explore the other scales, I really encourage you to purchase Erin Meyer's book, The Culture Map, or to have a look at her website. She uses a lot of stories, and it's a really eye-opening and enjoyable read with, for me, just many of those light bulb aha kind of moments along the way. So one of the concerns raised about mapping countries on these kinds of scales is about variations within a culture. So the questions might be asked, what about personality or subcultures or organisational culture? So in Australia, for example, our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples would sit in a different location on many of these scales to the place where Australia has been mapped. We've not included communication and feedback preferences for our Indigenous peoples in this presentation for that reason, but I really would like to acknowledge that communication in this circumstance is vitally important. Within current ACRM registrars, almost 4% identify themselves as being Aboriginal, Torres Strait Islander, or both. And across RACGP's training programs, there are 1.4% who identify as Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander, which is about 60 individuals. If you're working with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, I would really encourage you strongly to speak to them about their communication and feedback preferences. So Erimaya acknowledges that there's a spread within each country's culture, which she describes as a bell curve of preference. So the specific spot on the scale is given on the basis of the crest of the bell curve. And there's definitely overlap for individuals who might be on the sides of those bell curves, particularly in cultures that are close on the scale. And it's not so much about the absolute position on the scale, but rather where one person's culture sits in comparison to the culture of the person they're interacting with. So I've made up this hypothetical scale, which I've called the messiness scale. So my question to you is the UK a messy country or a clean country? You know, it's fairly close to the centre of the scale. It might be hard to determine. So on this imaginary messiness scale, a tourist from the UK visiting Australia might say, oh, Australians are so messy. They drop litter on the ground. They don't clean up after themselves. The UK is such a clean country. But then a Singaporean businessman, as an example, might be on a trip to the UK and he might describe the UK residents in exactly the same terms. Oh, they're so messy. They drop litter everywhere. Singapore is such a clean country in comparison, because they're relatively mapped to the same end of the messiness continuum, or the messiness scale. And I think many Australians will probably be shocked at how clean Singapore is in comparison to our own country. So the relative positions towards one end of the scale or the other is the most important part to consider. And many people find it hard to define or to map their own culture, or even to describe their own culture. And it's often when traveling outside of your home country that you start to notice the differences and start to see your own culture through other people's eyes. So one of the things you can do on the website is to actually choose individual countries and get them mapped across all of the 8 scales so that you can compare and look at those. China and Australia, our cultures are at opposite ends of the scales, and this can help us in understanding how to enhance communication. So if you remember my story from earlier about Sarah, the young woman from China, culturally, Sarah was leading those baby shower games in a completely appropriate manner. She was using a hierarchical leadership style to delegate the task to me and tell me what I needed to do. And why I, coming from a much more egalitarian leadership culture, reacted badly to what I felt like was a demand. And I just wanted to make a note here that if you have lived in 2 or more countries, or have parents who grew up in a different country to you, or if you grew up in Australia with parents who have immigrated here, you might find that this research helps you to understand the different spaces in which you live and how you might behave differently when relating to your parents in their home compared to relating to colleagues or to people in business or others. So this research might actually help you to understand yourself more fully than you have before. So let's look at the research on communicating. So the communicating scale is mapped from low context on one end to high context on the other. In low context communication, good communication is considered to be precise, simple, and clear. Messages are expressed and understood at face value. The words mean what the words mean. Repetition is appreciated if it helps clarify the communication. Whereas on the other end of the scale, in high context communication, good communication is considered to be sophisticated, nuanced, and layered. messages are both spoken in words and read between the lines. Messages are often implied, but not plainly expressed. So some of these descriptors might help in getting a sense of what these two ends of the spectrum might look like. And you might recognize some of these low context descriptors. So say what you mean and mean what you say. Or particularly in an education setting like this, tell them what you're going to tell them, then tell them, then tell them what you have told them, which sounds suspiciously like learning objectives and reviewing those learning objectives at the end of a presentation. In low context communication, active learning skills allow you to clearly understand meaning. And the responsibility for communication is with the speaker. So let me check, have I explained this clearly? Some of the high context descriptors might include things like, hear what I mean, not what I say. Or the phrase, read the air, meaning to read the context of the conversation. Or the French describe this as hearing what is under the heard. So listening to the underlying meaning rather than to the words themselves. So in these high context situations, everyone understands the unwritten rules of communicating. Some words can have different meanings depending on their context. For example, I learned last year that in Hindi, the same word is used for tomorrow and for yesterday. It's the same word, but the meaning depends on the context of its use. I fact checked this with a colleague who speaks Hindi, and she looked shocked when I suggested this initially and then thought about it and was surprised to say, actually, yes, they are the same word. So the context matters for meaning. Or in Mandarin, simply changing the tone in which a word is used can completely change its meaning. Australia and particularly the US and Canada are right down that low context end of the scale. So it appears that the history of a country might partly explain where it sits on this scale. So Australia or the US are very multicultural countries with relatively short history since European settlement. So the environment here and the communicating is low context because there's not a shared understanding of language and meaning. So communication needs to be simple, clear, and explicit with repetition used. Whereas Japan, that sits at the other extreme of the scale, is a stable island setting, monocultural, with a long history of being quite isolated as a country. So there's much more shared context and understanding, and less needs to be explicitly explained. The American anthropologist Edward Hall was the first person to develop this concept of low context and high context communication when he was working in Native American reservations back in the 1930s. So he used the analogy of marriage to describe the difference between high context and low context communication. So imagine what happens when two people are married for 50 or 60 years. Having shared the same context for so long, they can gather enormous amounts of information just by looking at each other's faces, at each other's body language, hearing each other's tones and gestures. Whereas newlyweds need to state their messages explicitly and repeat them more frequently to ensure they're received accurately. So that comparison might just help you to understand that sense of low context with perhaps a shorter shared history and high context in those countries where there's a greater shared history. So let's start thinking about this in the context of general practice training. Several years ago, I was asked to do an external clinical teaching visit for a registrar who had repeatedly failed the OSCE. So this was RACGP's clinical examination at that time. I was asked to give her feedback on her communication and her consultation skills. Over the first couple of consultations that I observed, I felt she was ignoring patient cues. The first patient we saw had expressed worry and concern about a possible diagnosis, and she just didn't even respond to this patient's worry. So we talked about the need to acknowledge and respond to patient cues, and in thinking about the exam, we came up with a phrase together that she could use in every single case of the exam, where she just said something like, I hear that you are concerned about X, Y, and Z. And this was felt a little bit like getting through the exam, but it was also about making sure the patient knew that she had heard them. But now, with my understanding of cultural communication, I'd potentially address this situation very differently. This registrar was a doctor from China, and she'd been a well-respected pediatrician before migrating to Australia and undertaking GP training in her 40s or 50s. Now, with my understanding of low context and high context communication, I think what this registrar was doing was being respectful of her patients in not explicitly mentioning the emotion or the cue. She had clearly understood their concern. She was able to tell me what their cue had been, what they had been concerned about when we discussed the consultation, but she hadn't mentioned it to the patient. And she'd certainly done her best to reassure the patient while explaining her management plan, understanding that context of anxiety and concern. So what I might say now is RACGP's clinical exam is an exam to assess competence to practice independently in an Australian context. In Australian culture, it is expected that you would explicitly acknowledge the emotion or cue from your patients, so the patient clearly knows you have heard them and have understood. So I hope you can see there how having some language around communicating can help in that kind of setting. So it's often miscommunication between people of low context and high context cultures. People in low context cultures like Australia, US, Canada may wrongly perceive high context communicators as being secretive, lacking transparency, hiding their real opinion, untrustworthy, lacking clarity. And people from high context cultures may wrongly perceive low context communicators as inappropriately stating the obvious, being condescending, patronizing, or judging others as stupid because they're repeating themselves over and over. And interestingly, it is often communication between one high context culture and another different high context culture where miscommunication is most likely to happen. So someone from Japan might read the air, thinking they've understood the meaning, whereas their Indian colleague may have actually meant something entirely different from the context of their culture. So it makes me wonder, you know, is the air different in Japan to what it is in India? You know, there's a real possibility for miscommunication from those high context to high context cultures. And I would just like to also make a specific mention about saying no across cultures. So saying no between the lines or underneath the meaning is common throughout many Asian cultures, particularly, especially when speaking to a boss or a client or an elder. One of my registrars recently told me that she needed to change practice for her upcoming term. The reason was that she was working in a suburb of Sydney where there was a large migrant population from the same cultural background as her parents. She shared that she was finding it almost impossible to say no to her patients, particularly when they were her elders. And the reason for this was that the cultural expectation was that as a young woman, she was expected to do whatever her elders asked, even when that conflicted with her own determination of what was good management and how she would be a good doctor. Many years ago now, we were playing Pictionary with a team of volunteer leaders from diverse cultural backgrounds. And my goodness, it was highly frustrating. Sam, a young man from Chinese heritage, could not say no. So with Pictionary, one person is drawing something and everyone else on their team has to guess what they're drawing. So he drew a circle and someone guessed ball and he said yes. Then someone else guessed it was a plate and he said yes. And someone else guessed it was the moon and he said yes. And we were all so confused. And needless to say, our team lost. But this actually led to a really helpful conversation about how to say no or how to raise an objection or a disagreement within that team without Sam having to say an outright no, or without him having to look like he was disagreeing with the leaders or with the others in the team. So when Sam said in a meeting, "Have you considered this alternative view?" we would know that this actually meant for him that he had some concerns and we needed to discuss this further to make sure we were all on the same page. This little scenario is outlined in the Culture Map book, and I thought it was worth just reading through this together. So Mr. Diaz was a Spanish executive working in China for a textile company. He states, "In China, the message up front is not necessarily the real message. My Chinese colleagues would drop hints and I wouldn't pick them up. Later, when thinking about it, I would realize I had missed something important." And he recounts this conversation he had with a Chinese employee. "So Mr. Diaz, it looks like some of us are going to have to be here on Sunday to host the client visit." "Mr. Chen, I see. Can you join us on Sunday?" "Yes, I think so." "Oh, that would be great. That would be a great help." "Yes, Sunday is an important day." "In what way?" "It's my daughter's birthday." "How nice. I hope you all enjoy it." "Thank you. I appreciate your understanding." So do you think Mr. Chen was coming to work on Sunday? Mr. Diaz was certain that he was, and Mr. Chen was certain he had communicated that he absolutely could not come because he was going to be celebrating his daughter's birthday with his family. So Mr. Diaz's top tip here was, if I'm not sure, I have to take responsibility to ask for clarification. In China, it is the responsibility of the learner to ensure that they have understood correctly. So I'd just like to encourage you to take a few moments to think about situations in your general practice, in general practice training, where you think there could be the impact of cultural differences in communication and what relationships might be impacted by that. Some of the examples I've thought of are things like how a registrar asks for help versus do they just look like they need help and expect you to reach out and offer? How can a registrar negotiate taking a weekend off from the roster if they have something else happening that weekend? Things like signposting and summarizing and paraphrasing, which we all consider really standard active listening skills in general practice consultations, they're actually really low context kind of listening skills and communicating skills. So they might need to be discussed explicitly with your registrar. Or orientation to your practice, how do you talk about culture and expectations and communication? So as you consider what we've talked about and think about how to apply this, I'll just really encourage you to think about how you might approach some of these situations where cultural differences are impacting on communication.
Just before you move on, I was just going to make the observation. I think both of you certainly know and maybe have even worked with Maria Dahm, who's a linguist in Canberra. And I remember a session that she ran and talked about the hazard about, it was interesting, Kathy, talking about use of phrases and how they can actually convey meaning, but they can also be perceived by the patient as just a kind of clunky, yes, I've heard you, but I haven't really heard you, let's move on. And how I just remember always trying to equip registrars with a phrase, this is a really useful thing to use, but if it's not employed in the right way, it actually can be counterproductive. And that's always stuck with me. So it's really interesting your reflection on how you might have managed that registrar in a different way, having understood the cultural differences better.
Definitely. All right, so the second, thanks for that, Simon. The second scale that we'll talk about is evaluating performance and providing negative feedback. Positive feedback is pretty safe and non-inflammatory, and all cultures believe in providing constructive criticism, but what this looks like will not be the same for every culture. You know, the intention of feedback, or one of the intentions, is for improvement, for growth, for learning. We know that it's not always received that way. We know that feedback can be difficult to receive as well as to deliver. And I think we've all been involved in situations both providing and receiving feedback, negative feedback, and can recognise when things haven't quite gone to plan. And so this is a way to think about, could there be other factors at play? Interestingly, you might think that communicating and evaluating would be linear and go hand in hand. And it's actually that communicating is only one part of evaluating, which is an important twist. So some cultures which are low context and explicit communicators may actually cryptically be indirect with their negative feedback, whereas cultures who speak between the lines may be explicit straight talkers when telling you what you did wrong. And so some cultures completely swap places on the communicating and evaluating scales, which can be confusing. So the two ends of this scale are direct negative feedback and indirect negative feedback. So the direct negative feedback is often delivered frankly, bluntly, honestly. The messages stand alone. They're not softened by positive ones. Absolute descriptors are often used to emphasize the message. And criticism may be given to an individual in front of a group. In comparison, indirect negative feedback is provided softly, subtly, diplomatically. Positive messages are used to wrap negative ones, qualifying descriptors are used, and criticism must be given in private. Very, very important. We mentioned some upgraders being used. So direct cultures use upgraders to strengthen the message. This makes the message more direct. It emphasizes the importance. There are words like absolutely, definitely don't do that. You need to pay attention. That was unacceptable and inappropriate. Whereas indirect cultures use downgraders to soften or to lessen the message and to decrease that personal impact. Maybe, perhaps, have you thought about, you could consider. Another option might be, what do you think? Do you recognize any of these phrases? Do you use them yourself? I personally find that the tone changes with these words, and it's a forced, explicit thing to take tone out of it to change the message. I find this stuff just absolutely fascinating. So because of the interplay between communication and evaluation, there are kind of four groups. So we'll go through the different groups. So group A are considered low context communicators who give direct negative feedback. They're considered blunt, rude, offensive. Messages are simple, honest, transparent, and respectful of your profession. They're not meant to cause offense, so don't take it personally. It's honesty is a gift. So here we've got Dutch, German, Danish colleagues, and Australia sits in this quadrant. You wouldn't think so. Quadrant B, we've got our high context communicators, and they provide direct negative feedback. So these cultures usually read between the lines, but they provide direct feedback, which is quite startling, especially to subordinates. And the French, for example, use praise quite sparingly. So then when you get this, you know, direct negative message, it's really quite stark. So in here, we've got Australia, Russians, and some European countries, Italy, Spain, France. Moving over to quadrant C, we've got our low context communicators who give indirect negative feedback. And so these very transparent communicators, but they soften their feedback, which can be really quite confusing. So the US are always a good example. They're very effusive with their praise. Everything's wonderful and great. And they tend to give three positive messages for one negative message. And so that negative feedback is so buried and so blurred that it's often not heard and misunderstood. So yeah, we've got the US, the UK and the Canadians here. So this is quite a funny little Anglo-Dutch translation guide, which really demonstrates the impact of miscommunication. So when the British say, with all due respect, the British mean, I think you're wrong, and the Dutch understand, he's listening to me. When the British say, oh, by the way, what they mean is the following criticism is the purpose of this discussion. The Dutch hear, this isn't very important. When the British say, I'm sure it's my fault. The British mean, it's not my fault. The Dutch hear, it's his fault. So we can understand how this isn't going to go well at all. It's supposed to be humorous, but there is elements of truth to this guide. So we'll finish with quadrant D. So here there is that linear relationship of the high context communicators who provide indirect negative feedback. The feedback is slowly given over a period of time and it gradually helps you build a picture. So you'll leave a little nugget here and another little kernel. And there's this concept of blurring the message. So one of the examples given in Erin's book is that it's recommended that you take a person out for a meal and you've sent some messages along the way, but you go to the meal, you tell them all the positive things, you purposefully leave out the negative, and they understand the message. Blows my mind. I wouldn't get it. And the other very important thing here is that negative feedback cannot be given to an individual in a group setting. So again, in the book, there's examples where people have tendered their resignations when this has happened, because a lot of these cultures are quite hierarchical, and so saving face is very important. A top tip is that understanding those cultural contexts, norms, behaviours is very important. Copying them and emulating them when they are not your own is a danger zone. So do it at your own risk. If you deliver feedback in the same style as the home country, especially if they're more direct, their nuances and those unwritten rules can be lost. And again, the book goes through examples where it's gone very, very badly. So I thought, we all love an example. I thought that I would use a medical record review example to illustrate direct and indirect feedback. So direct feedback. John, I've reviewed your medical records from the consult I just observed. In future, make sure that you've checked the typos and that grammar is correct. It is inappropriate to have information about allergies missing, especially when writing prescriptions because of medico-legal requirements. You must clearly document that you advise the patient to go to ED if this pain worsens. In comparison, indirect feedback. John, I've reviewed your medical records from the consult I just observed. May I suggest you review the patient details page so you can record the allergies before prescribing? What do you think? Think about your safety netting advice. Would you consider any changes to your roles? Can you see the differences? I tried really hard to keep the tone the same so it wasn't confusing the message. Once you've read these different upgraders and downgraders, when you hear yourself give feedback, you notice, or I was noticing, how often we just say things out of habit. I think the take-home activity is to go home and just that self-reflection of what do you do. And we also tend to give feedback in the way that we like to receive, probably a bit unconsciously. One of the other examples in the book was about a French executive moving and working in the US. And Erin was having a catch-up with both parties, so the French and the American party, following the performance review. And the French lady was glowing. It's the best performance review I've ever had. I love it. It was, you know, it's so wonderful. Her American boss was like, I don't know what to do. She's not hearing my feedback. I've tried so hard. I'm going to have to fire her. So those polar opposites are really interesting. And it's, again, is the French lady unreceptive to feedback? Or is the US style of providing feedback where it's kind of couched and clouded and hidden, so it's really kind of hard to understand and hear? And it's really unhelpful for us to use labels like resistant feedback, lack of insight, etc. So these are some questions for you to think about. Now, the someone could be your registrar, could be your practice manager, medical educator, CT visitor. If someone is more used to more direct feedback, we may feel as though our feedback is not being heard and not being taken seriously. If someone is used to indirect feedback, they may be hurt or defensive about feedback they perceive as rude, judgmental, and harsh. So having a think about different expectations, different preferences, different styles, and then trying to filter that message. So if you prefer direct feedback, but you're being given indirect feedback, take out the downgraders. Hear what that real message is. If you prefer indirect feedback, but you were given a direct message, don't be offended. Think about what was actually said and the intention's not to hurt you. So, practical tips time. And in our low context way, we're going to go through these. Over to Kath first.
I experienced one of those feedback situations after the first time that we presented on this topic, where my Zimbabwean friend, who's usually very indirect with her communication style, gave me some very direct feedback. And I really struggled with it. It really took me several days to think about that and to soften it a bit in my own language to think about how I might have received it better. And yeah, that whole sense of acknowledging that this was her delivering feedback in a cultural way and that that was appropriate for her. So I've got a couple of practical tips in the communicating space. And one of those is when you're speaking to someone or when someone is communicating with you from a culture that's a higher context than your own, is to remember that the responsibility for understanding is on you as the listener. So if you're not certain that you've understood what the person is saying, if you think, oh, there's a meaning behind what they're saying, but I'm just not getting it, then it's appropriate to really listen, to think about how they're appearing and to ask those clarifying questions. So listen first and then, yeah, ask those clarifying questions. And one of the tips around communicating between two different cultures that are both high context is to have some low context processes. So one of the things that I mean by that is, you know, when you're doing an orientation to your practice, you might consider including culture and how we communicate in this practice or what your preferences for communication are. And that might look like something along the lines of talking to the registrar about how to ask for help. So if you feel like you need help, be explicit in requesting that. So reach out to me in this way, via message or via knocking on my door or whatever the process is in your practice, but being really explicit about what the process is for communication.
Can I just add on that one is also saying the expectation is, especially say GPT-1s, if you don't ask me for help, I'm going to worry. And these are the things I want to be called for. These are the non-negotiables as well. So it has to be tailored to the different stage of training. But yeah, being explicit.
And particularly in that context of a GPT-1 registrar who's come from a hospital environment where there's a whole different organisational culture as well, setting those expectations about what you would like to happen for communicating within your practice and being able to use some of these terms around communication to express what the expectations are and what your hope is as a practice, I think is really important. Back to you, Marisa.
Yeah, so my other tips are just that real understanding that we're such a melting pot in Australia and that really 50% of us, be it your colleagues, your registrars, your patients, probably have two cultures at a minimum that are blending and making them up. And assumptions are problematic and we can't tell what those cultures are by looking at someone, you know, by the spelling of their name or anything else. And so having those explicit conversations and normalising it in our low context way. And the other thing about feedback is, again, this is the purpose, this is what we're going to use it for, what do you like? Again, starting that dialogue. And this is an iterative process, so it's continuing dialogue. Thinking about group settings. So if you have multiple registrars at your practice, where the Australian way is that you would, you know, give feedback in front of peers, that may actually need to be modified. Yeah, and thinking about those upgraders and downgraders and the language, they would be my tips. And that this is just the start. So we do recommend that everyone gets a copy of the book, reads it, have a lot of your own aha moments. So again, because it is just the start, it's a little taster. Some more things for you to go home and to mull over and to consider, maybe talk about with your colleagues. Is, I guess it's about getting to know yourself. So what do you like? How do you approach situations? What are your experiences with cultural differences impacting on communication? How would you communicate with someone of a lower context or higher context culture than yourself? Is it using the low context stuff that we've talked about, being specific? As Kath said, where those have come around was because there wasn't that shared understanding. And often we're building that in our practices, in our supervisor registrar relationships, etc. And also think about, I think the really powerful one with communicating is the saying no and the different dynamics and hierarchical relationships, even if we are more of an egalitarian society. So just having a think about where that difficulty may lie, where some challenges may be, and maybe identify those and preempt them and give some options and language around that as well. What else would you like? You know, this is the start of the conversation. So having a think about what other supports. And over to Simon.
GPSA now has an online community platform. I think we'd probably really encourage maybe a conversation around this because, I mean, this is completely fascinating. Thank you so much for your conveying what I imagine is an extraordinary amount of research and work into really accessible language and understanding, and also how we as supervisors and educators can apply that in our practice. It's, as you say, it really is quite fascinating. And when you apply it to our day-to-day interactions with friends and colleagues and those sorts of relationships, it's sort of fundamental as it gets. So we would encourage, absolutely, I think, an ongoing conversation around this. You may be keen for us as an organisation to develop some resources, and we'd be keen to know about, you know, what you'd like. I think we're conscious at GPSA often of delivering an educational session that's interesting and people take something away, but I think we'd like to see this as an ongoing conversation in a sense. And I think a great place to start, as you've talked about, is to get the book and to read that and put that into context. It's interesting, isn't it, this whole notion of not wanting to stereotype, and you know, appropriately covered that at the outset, and these are broad cultural definitions. What is your approach? You know, you talk about engaging the individual in front of you, but practically, how do we avoid stereotyping? How do we actually genuinely get a sense of how a individual registrar wants to or is most comfortable communicating and receiving feedback? I was reflecting on the fact that if we say to someone, well, do you want to just hear the feedback, you know, up front? And it's almost sort of a bit soft to go, no, no, I want you to cushion it somehow. You know, it's almost this sense that we have to say, yeah, of course, just give it to me. But that's probably not appropriate. And so, yeah, I'd be curious to know what your experience has been in that regard.
I have had one situation where someone that my husband was supervising in a work setting actually specifically said to him, I can't handle getting positive feedback and negative feedback in the same conversation. So when we have our review, can we have two conversations, please? Can you tell me what I've done well and what you think my strengths are? And next week we can talk about what you think I need to improve and what you... So that person was actually very self-aware in knowing what they needed. So I think that's where we're reading this book and understanding this helps to give some of that language to these conversations. And you could even do it as a self-disclosure. So when I receive feedback, I like people to leave the responsibility with me and to make suggestions on what I might consider for improvement, which would be some of those indirect kind of words, which I love to use when I'm giving feedback as well, with the perhaps and maybe and have you thought about and have you considered. They're all very Kath kind of words. But you can then open that conversation around, is that what you prefer? Or would you prefer me just to tell you straight, this is what I think you need to work on? So, yeah, just having some words around that language and asking the question, I think, can be helpful.
I would agree. I think it's normalized. And starting with your example, this is what I'm used to, or this is how it's done in Australia. Have you had different experiences? And I think a lot of it is we make a lot of assumptions that people have gone through the Australian system and they're used to it and indoctrinated. But again, there are resources for registrars about feedback models and for supervisors through both colleges, through GPSA as well. Are they always read? So I think it's, again, it's not a one size fits all. It's having the conversation with new registrars. And hopefully the examples we've given you will help, but that's a really good suggestion to add some more, you know, prompts in. Because this, as we said at the start, you know, this is quite a new topic. Once you read it, you think, oh, really, we should all know about it. But it's quite a new idea to be sharing as well. And then Alison's question is about how to help resolve cross-cultural miscommunication between registrars and patients without undermining our registrar's relationship. I've reflected on some of my consults and gone, yeah, I missed the mark there. I didn't get it. There was lots of nods and yeses and actually nothing went through. There was too much probably politeness. So I think it's understanding it's a journey. We're not going to get it straight away. But part of it is, if things aren't going as we expect, could this be one of the elements? And so again, depending on where you're working and what your patient demographics, part of orientation, maybe these are our practice demographics. These is the age, the background, sociocultural, you know, whatever things are relevant. These are the things we've noticed have been challenging for all our team or for our trainees or however you want to word it. So a bit of that, again, normalization. And maybe it's one of the things that in direct observation that there's a focus on as well. So I think observing is probably going to be helpful, and you might get some hints about how that communication is happening with other practice staff members to see where there might be some of those gaps. Kath, any thoughts?
Yeah, I really like that sense of normalizing. So it's like when you see the 45-year-old man who's got a back injury, and so you normalize the fact that a lot of men who have a back injury feel like they can't achieve their normal activities and might feel depressed because of not being able to utilize their body in a normal way. And so you can open that discussion about depression or about the impacts of this back pain. In a similar way, I think normalizing talking about culture can be really helpful. So, you know, what we found is that a lot of people, when they're communicating across cultures, find communication tricky or can easily miscommunicate when they're communicating between different cultures that are high context, and you know, explaining what that high context means and being able to think about what the expectation is around that Australian culture. And yeah, just normalizing those kind of conversations, normalizing that language, I think can be a really powerful thing.
You mentioned, Marissa, in terms of feedback, seeking self-assessment from the learner. And that I read a systematic review recently of a whole range of feedback models. The one thing I didn't do in reviewing that paper was to see where they're from. And it's interesting to get a sense of whether they actually all came from similar cultural background countries. Because the common theme was ask the learner what they thought they did well. But yeah, I mean, and that seems to be, okay, well, that's a universal, but maybe in the wrong context, that isn't an appropriate thing to do.
Yes, I can remember in my early ECTVs, I was taught first Pendleton's rules and exactly that. So ask the registrar what they did well and later ask them what they think they could have improved on. And I had always put it down to personality when some registrars could list 20 things that they did well and struggled to find something they should have improved, to the point one of my registrars once said, well, I can't think of anything I should have done differently because you're here and you're observing me. So I've done everything I could possibly have done because you were watching. And then you get your other registrars who just, you ask them what they did well and they just can't tell you a single thing, but they can tell you 20 things they could have done differently. And I'd always put that down, as I said, to personality, but I think actually culture definitely, and that sense of saving face in expressing your own mistakes as well, can really interplay into that. So it would be fascinating to know the cultures from which the different models of feedback have come from.
I'm just interested in this question. So who actually would have any kind of conversation with their registrars at the beginning of term about feedback and how it's delivered in the practice, how maybe the learner, the registrar would like to have that delivered? Maybe even as you talked about, Marissa, you know, what the purpose is, why it's given, how it's best received, that sort of thing. Because I suspect it's low, which is okay, but I also think there's scope to really improve that facet of what we do at orientation, and not just show the registrar where the defibrillator is, which is kind of important, but also this is the way the teaching and learning will occur in the practice, and including feedback. But I think for me, a message is very much that orientation to communication and feedback from what you've talked about in the setting of a cultural difference, but probably fairly universally.
Yeah, one of the things that's mentioned in the book is that people will often give feedback in the way they like to receive it. So that's another opportunity with your registrar, is to actually ask for feedback from your registrar about how you've done your orientation or about how they're settling into the practice. It might be a little bit tricky if you're the boss, and therefore they might be a bit less direct than they might otherwise have been. But listening to some of those words and the upgraders and the downgraders that they might use in their conversations with patients or with you or with staff in giving feedback, I think can give you that little bit of an idea or a bit of a hint as to how they might actually like to receive feedback.
It is overwhelming, all the new information, and especially as a GPT1, and you know, that very first time you're coming into general practice, everything's new. Subsequent terms, you've got a bit of an idea and you're a bit more savvy and you know what to ask for. So if you weren't showing the emergency equipment, you know, until week three, you'll be asking for it, you know, straight up. But I see orientation as a not on the one day, it's a bit of a continual process. So is it when you're discussing your teaching sessions and setting up the direct observation sessions and those formative assessments, and that you bring it in? So it doesn't have to be day one, but it can be brought in during that orienting period. And we know, because it's so overwhelming, we actually need, you know, university curriculums are a spiral for a reason. We build, it's all foundational. So again, we have to revisit things a few times. And sometimes we're gonna break down those barriers. So as Kath said, when they give feedback, it might be, I'm doing what you expect me to do, with a little bit of what I normally do in there. So hopefully we have covered our three learning objectives of explaining some international research about differences in communication and feedback, identifying situations where culture may impact communication feedback in general practice training, and some practical tips. So Erin's team have mapped about 67 different countries. So the book's got some, you go to the website and there's a whole other range. So for some people, it was even thinking about, oh, this is why the practice manager and someone else may be, you know, butting heads because of this impact, etc. So it's beneficial, or family members, do with it what you will. But we thought we'd share that bit of info.
The only other question was, would the college provide some questions that would help provide a framework for how registrars would like to receive feedback at induction? And I think that's a really, you know, that's something that we could certainly have a think about. That's a really good what now, and maybe a practical application of this.
I think I just want to touch on Shruti's comment as well about, you know, checking in at that 3-month mark about getting feedback about how the practice is going. And that's another normalizing thing as well. You know, it's a two-way street. It's not just me giving you feedback. I want to know how I'm going. The practice wants to know, etc. And we do encourage registrars to have those open and honest conversations. Because when they become fellows, they need to have these conversations advocating for themselves as well. So again, without making orientation and induction onerous, it is really important.
Look, I just found that this really has been one of the most interesting discussions that I've been part of for a long time in this domain. And again, you've found an area, I think, that's both underexplored and considered, but also incredibly important. And I look forward to kind of continuing those discussions. So thanks very much, Kath. Thanks, Marissa.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks. Bye.
Thanks for listening. We'd love your feedback. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please give us a rating and or a review. And if you haven't already, please subscribe and share this podcast with your colleagues. If you'd like to ask a question or suggest a topic, you can reach out to us via our social channels. Simply search GP Supervision Australia on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, or Twitter. GP Supervision Australia is supported by funding from the Australian Government under the Australian General Practice Training Program.